Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Okay, we continue now with the discussion of Sutta number 36, the Mahasachaka Sutta. And we've come to the passage on page 340 where the Bodhisattva has been seeking a way to enlightenment by subjecting himself to these extremely painful austerities, following the practice of self-mortification. And then he has recalled an experience when he was a child, when his father went to the plowing festival and left him sitting in the shade of the rose apple tree, and just spontaneously, without any instruction, somehow he knew to cross his legs, and he entered into the first meditative absorption, the first jhana. According to the commentary, this happened by attending to his in-and-out breathing. So it was the mindfulness of breathing that he was practicing. And in this state, he experienced a sublime piti and sukha, rapture and bliss, which had nothing to do with sensual pleasures. And the thought occurred to him now, when he was recalling that experience, that maybe this is the path to enlightenment. Then following on that memory, there came to him the realization that this is the path to enlightenment, and that he has nothing to be afraid of in the pleasure and the bliss of that meditative state, because it is not tainted by sensual desires and by any other unwholesome states. So that's as far as we got last time. And now we continue with paragraph number 33. As you know from what's come before, the Bodhisattva has undertaken such extreme austerities, fasting for long periods, reducing his intake of food, till his body had become so emaciated that if he wanted to touch his belly, he could feel his spine through the belly, and if he went to touch his back, he could feel his stomach through the back. And so he realized that it would not be possible for him to attain this meditative state with a body which has become so excessively emaciated. And so he decides to take some solid food. He starts going on alms round to the village some distance away and collecting food and eating normal meals. I mean, it would probably be in line with the monastic practice of that time, eating one meal a day, but it would have been a substantial enough meal for his body to start to regain its strength, to put on normal weight. And at that time, according to the text here, there were five fellow ascetics who were called bhikkhus here. They were not yet ordained Buddhist monks, but they're called bhikkhu in the sense the word bhikkhu comes from the root of the stem form bhikkha, which means alms food, food collected as alms. And so one who lives on alms food is called a bhikkhu. So these five ascetics were attending on the Bodhisattva and serving him, thinking that he's a very superior, very determined, very zealous and assiduous practitioner. And they must have gone around and explored all of the different spiritual seekers of the time. And they were so impressed by the Bodhisattva that they thought if anybody is going to attain enlightenment and true spiritual realization, it's going to be this person. strangely, no mention is made earlier in the narrative of the five bhikkhus. Suddenly they just appear in the text. So we can assume that the narrative has been put together through disjointed pieces, perhaps. Okay, so now when the bodhisattva starts to eat solid food and to regain his normal weight, then these five bhikkhus became disgusted with him, disillusioned with him, thinking that now he's given up the spiritual seeking, he's no longer striving for enlightenment, but he's just resigned himself to live a luxurious life, taking it easy, leading a comfortable life with the support of devoted householders. And so there's no point following him, expecting him to attain enlightenment. And so they go away and they leave him. Now, often it happens that when the person is left all alone in the world with nobody else to fall back upon, with no company, with no companionship, when he's thrown into complete solitude, that becomes the occasion for the deepest spiritual realizations. And so this happened in the case of the Bodhisattva too. After he had taken solid food for some time and regained his strength, then according to a traditional account, I don't remember the sequence, maybe some of you know the full story better than I do, but there came the time when he decided that this night he was going to make the full determination for enlightenment. Then he passed somebody who collects the dry grass. He took some dry grass from him and prepared a seat under the tree that came to be known as the Bodhi tree or enlightenment tree. And then there was a woman living nearby. She was the daughter of the village headman. Her name was Sujata. And she had made a vow that she would make an offering to the spirit of the tree. She made a vow for something, I don't remember what it was, that if something came to pass, she would make an offering to the spirit of this tree. And then what she wanted had come to pass. And so she prepared some what's called in India payasan, which is honeyed rice porridge with milk and rice and honey. Very, very fine and tasty dish. And then she came bringing it to the tree, just to offer it to the tree deity. And then when she saw the bodhisattva sitting under the tree, with very beautiful, handsome appearance, she thought that this must be the tree deity himself. And so then she offered the payasan, the rice porridge, to the bodhisattva. Then he ate the porridge, and after eating it, he took the bowl in which it was presented to him, and he went to the river and started to wash it. But then the question came into his mind, if I am to attain enlightenment this day, let the bowl float upstream rather than downstream. And then the bowl floated upstream rather than downstream. So he knew that night he was to attain enlightenment. And so then, as night comes, he sits under the Bodhi tree. In fact, here we are now recounting the same passage which we already encountered in Sutta number 4 in the Bhayabhairava Sutta. And so now, secluded from unwholesome states, secluded from sensual pleasures, secluded from unwholesome states, he enters and dwells in the first jhana. Then he goes into the second, third, fourth jhana. In each case, he says, but the pleasant feeling that arose in me did not invade my mind and remain. This ties back to the original theme of this sutta, which I mentioned last week, that this theme is that the Buddha did not feel any kind of pain which was so afflictive that it obsessed his mind when he was undergoing the ascetic practices. And now when he enters into these extremely blissful, peaceful, jhanic states, the pleasant feeling, the bliss blissful feeling does not persist in obsessing his mind. Okay, so then he directs the mind to the recollection of previous lives. He recalls his previous lives. Then he directs his mind to the passing away and rebirth of beings. And he sees how beings arise and pass away in accordance with their karma. And then he directs his mind to the knowledge of the destruction of the asavas, the taints. He realizes the Four Noble Truths. Then his mind is liberated from all of the asavas, the taints, the fundamental, the deep fundamental defilements, and there comes to him the knowledge of liberation, that the mind is liberated. He knows birth is destroyed, the holy life has been lived, what had to be done has been done. There is no more coming to back to any state of conditioned existence. And even when that knowledge of enlightenment arose in him, according to paragraph 44, such pleasant feeling that arose in me did not invade my mind and remain. If you think I'm going very quickly through this, this is because it's just pretty much a repetition of sutta number 4, which we already covered. Okay, now at this point, I'm not going to finish the rest of the sutta, though you can read it on your own, because I just wanted to cover the Buddha's account of his enlightenment experience. And now we go back to sutta number 26, to the passage where we left the Bodhisattva about 3 weeks ago, sitting under the Bodhi tree, where we left him off. This is page 259, sutta number 26, paragraph 17. The Bodhisattva has just discovered this delightful and agreeable piece of land with a delightful grove, with a clear flowing river and smooth banks, and with a village for alms nearby. And he sits there thinking, this will be a good place for me to make my great exertion. And then he sits down there thinking to devote himself to striving. So what took place when the Bodhisattva sat down there, according to this sutta, it seems like he immediately attained enlightenment. But in fact, he would have spent perhaps 6 years undergoing various ascetic practices till he became disillusioned with the path of self-mortification. And now that he has discovered the true way, leading through the jhanas, the four jhanas, then into the three higher knowledges, and he's liberated the mind from all of the taints. Now he can speak in paragraph 18. But to understand 18 in context, we have to refer back to the same sutta, paragraph 13, just a couple of pages earlier, when we see the Bodhisattva goes out and forth into the homeless life. He does so because he is himself subject to birth, aging, sickness, death, sorrow, and defilement. And so he goes forth seeking the unborn, unaging, that which is free from illness, for the unailing, deathless, sorrowless, and undefiled supreme security from bondage, Nibbana. So that was his original purpose in entering upon the homeless life and making this great exertion. And now in paragraph 18, having found the path, followed the path through to its consummation, reached the highest knowledge, and liberated his mind from all of the bonds, fetters, and defilements, now he can say, as a kind of conclusion to the quest, the noble quest, then, bhikkhus, being myself subject to birth, having understood the danger in what is subject to birth, seeking the unborn supreme security from bondage, nibbana, I attained the unborn supreme security from bondage, nibbana. Being myself subject to aging, etc., I attain the unaging supreme security from bondage, nibbana. Being myself subject to sickness, I attain the unailing or illness-free supreme security from bondage, nibbana. Being myself subject to death, I attain the deathless supreme security from bondage. Being myself subject to sorrow, I attain the sorrowless supreme security from bondage, nibbana. Being myself subject to defilement, I attain the undefiled supreme security from bondage, nibbana. The knowledge of vision and vision arose in me. My deliverance, the mukti, is unshakable. This is my last birth. Now there is no renewal of being, no more punabhava, no repeated existence in the future. And so now the Buddha has, or now the Bodhisattva has become, is no longer the Bodhisattva, but now he is the Buddha for the first time, really, the perfectly, fully enlightened one. And now, according to the traditional account of the Buddha's life, before the next paragraph takes place, before the consideration in the next paragraph takes place, according to the narrative in the Vinaya Pitaka, the newly enlightened Buddha spent 4 weeks in the vicinity of the Bodhi tree, contemplating in different ways the Dharma, the truth that he had realized. Then in the commentaries, the period is lengthened, extended up to 7 weeks. So there's a traditional account of 49 days spent in the vicinity of the Bodhi tree. And different traditions ascribe different events to that period. According to the Theravada tradition, within that period, the newly enlightened Buddha contemplated the Abhidhamma Pitaka. According to the later Mahayana tradition, in this period, the disclosure of the Avatamsaka Sutra took place. But this is a period in which you could say that the Buddha, with his enlightenment, fully awakened to the complete Dhamma, in the sense that the Dhamma, the truth of the Dhamma realm, was fully accessible to him. But it would have taken some time to explore all of the different ramifications of this realization, to look at it from different angles, to draw out all of the implications. And now, as the Buddha is sitting there, a new consideration starts to dawn on him, or a new challenge starts to dawn on him. And this is the question whether he should try to teach, to communicate the Dhamma that he has realized. And as he is sitting there, he thinks to himself, this Dhamma that I have attained is profound, hard to see, hard to understand, peaceful and sublime, unattainable by mere reasoning or logic, subtle to be experienced by the wise. But this generation, not generation in the sense of beat generation or X generation, generation in the sense of humankind, we could say, delights in, here the word is translated worldliness, which is not so satisfactory, takes delight in worldliness, rejoices in worldliness. The actual Pali Sanskrit word is alaya. Yeah, the word alaya is connected with the idea of clinging or adherence. So now I think in the Samyutta Nikaya translation, I think I rendered it adhesion. So this humankind delights in adhesion. In other words, they delight in attachment to worldly pleasures. They take delight in adhesion, rejoice in adhesion. And the commentary explains that they take delight both in the objects of the senses, the five chords of sensual pleasure, delightful form, sound, smells, tastes, and touches, and also they take delight in the clinging to these pleasures. It is hard for such a generation to see this truth or this principle, namely specific conditionality, dependent origination. And it is hard to see this truth, namely the stilling of all formations, that is, the quieting down, the subsiding of all conditioned phenomena, the relinquishing of all acquisitions, the giving up of all objects of attachment, the destruction of craving, dispassion, cessation, nirvana. And all the terms here, the stilling of all formations and so on, are all in a sense synonyms for nirvana. So in this passage, very concisely, we could see what seemed to be the two main aspects of the Buddha's realization through his enlightenment. On the one hand, there is the aspect of dependent origination. This is paticca-samuppada. It's also called specific conditionality. The Pali word is idapachayata, which means, it comes from idang, which means this, plus pachaya, which means condition. So this is the origination of things in dependence upon specific conditions. And so these two aspects of the Buddha's enlightenment, we could say, embrace all conditioned and unconditioned phenomena. The dependent origination is what the law or principle which embraces the entire conditioned world. It is the law that applies to everything which is, if we go to the preceding passage, everything which is subject to birth, aging, sickness, death, sorrow, defilement, sorrow and defilement. And then the nibbana, the unconditioned, is that which is free from birth, aging, sickness, death, sorrow, and defilement. And so from these two principles, one could see how which were realized through the enlightenment, you could see how the Buddha would have designed the Four Noble Truths. We take, in fact, dependent origination is the second noble truth, which leads into the first noble truth of suffering. And nibbana is the third noble truth, which implies the path, the Noble Eightfold Path, as the way to the extinction of suffering. And so the Buddha would have seen at this time, as contemplating these principles he had realized, seeing that they're so difficult to see and understand, he's afraid that if he were to try to teach the Dhamma, others would just look at him without any comprehension and say, "Why are you speaking to us? Why don't you just lead a normal life like the rest of us? Or if you're really an ascetic, why don't you take up some ascetic practices? And then nobody would understand him, and then this would just be wearisome and troublesome for him. And then some verses occur to him spontaneously, which express the feeling that he has at this time. He says to himself, enough with teaching the Dhamma. In other words, it seems almost as though he's deciding not to try to teach. That even I found hard to reach, for it will never be perceived by those who live in lust and hate, those dyed in lust, wrapped in darkness, will never discern this abstruse or profound Dhamma, which goes against the stream, the worldly stream, subtle, deep, and difficult to see. And the Buddha says, as I was considering this, my mind inclined to inaction rather than to teaching the Dhamma. And this raises an interesting question here. Like, we're always taught in the Buddhist tradition, whether Theravada or Mahayana, that the Buddha, as a bodhisattva, had spent so many aeons developing the paramis, paramitas, in order to become a Buddha, specifically, expressly for the purpose of teaching the Dhamma in the world. And now, just when the opportunity is open to him, when he's fulfilled his mission, he decides, no, better just keep quiet and to stay living peacefully in the forest. I can do my meditation here, enjoy the bliss of Nibbana within myself, and let the world go its own way. So why doesn't he, on his own accord, take that great, where is all that great compassion that he supposedly has, to go out and teach the world? The commentary gives one explanation. I have some other thoughts about this. What the commentary says is that the Buddha actually speaks this passage, or has recorded this passage, as a way of, because previously he had never really, as a bodhisattva, fully appreciated how deep and difficult to understand the Dhamma is, and also he had never really fully understood how thick and obstructive are the defilements in the minds of sentient beings. So now, for the first time, this is becoming manifest to him. But also, this is again according to the commentary, the Buddha had a little sort of trick up his sleeve, you might say, in that he knew that it's part of the fixed order of things, part of the natural law, you could say, that after a Buddha attains complete enlightenment, they all have this initial reluctance to teach, and then one of the Brahma deities will come and manifest before the Buddha and make a petition to them, an entreaty, beseeching them to teach the Dhamma. And it so happens in the world, especially in India at that time, that the dominant religious form was Brahmanism, and the Brahmins were devotees of Brahma, the god Brahma. And so if it becomes known that Mahabrahma, or one of the Mahabrahma deities, has come and requested the Buddha to teach and places himself in a position of subservience to the Buddha, then all, or at least many of the followers of the Brahma god will become devotees of the Buddha. Okay, that is the way the commentary explains. I have something to add to that. This is my understanding, is that all of the Buddha, the Bodhisattva's quest for enlightenment up to the moment of enlightenment represents what we would call, I call this the ascending movement of the Buddha Dhamma. It's the movement from within samsara leading up to nibbana, the movement from ignorance leading to enlightenment, the movement from worldliness to the transcendence of the world. But for the Dhamma to be complete, there also has to be what we can call the movement of, okay, the first movement is the movement of ascendance. The second is the movement of descent, the coming down into the world. Not returning to a worldly life, but coming back into the world. And the movement, in the movement of ascent or rising out, the dominant faculty is panya or wisdom, because it's wisdom which sees through all of the delusions constructed by ignorance, and wisdom which is able to light up the path of truth, wisdom which discerns the true principles of things, wisdom which destroys the defilements. And then through wisdom, the Buddha now has risen completely above the world, become completely transcendent to the world. But it is somehow written into the nature of things as a principle that for, now what is going to bring the movement of descent back into the world is the other corresponding aspect of the Dhamma, which is the aspect of karuna, or compassion. And for this compassion to be awakened in the Buddha, it's not that it's ever really been dispelled in any way, but for it to be awakened, the call has to come from within the world to the Buddha, asking him to return to the world and undertake the work of compassion by teaching the Dhamma. Now, this is my conjecture, that if the Buddha of his own initiative were to go out and start teaching the Dhamma, it could indicate a little bit, even a trace of some kind of attachment remaining in him, as though he's out to set himself up as a teacher, maybe, like we know many people these days, they learn a little Buddhism, then maybe do some meditation courses, then before you know it, in the pop New Age journals, you see this banner headlines, so-and-so is now authorized to teach, he'll be giving courses in such and such a period, sign up and submit, send your check made out to so-and-so. So I'm not quite saying that it goes quite that far, but there would be a little bit of some kind of maybe clinging to the position of a teacher. But when the call, the request for teaching comes from within the world, then it gives the fully enlightened Buddha now the opportunity to again reflect upon the nature of living beings, you call it the plight of sentient beings, and then it gives the opportunity for that compassion to arise from within himself and to stir him or spur him to the activity, the mission of teaching. And so now, at this moment when the Buddha, when his mind is inclining to inaction, then one of the high divinities named Brahma Sahampati, according to the commentary, this Brahma Sahampati had formerly been a monk during the time of a previous Buddha, and he had developed the first jhana, and he had been reborn in the Brahma world. That's where the commentary, actually there's also a sutta which supports that. But it seems to me that Brahma Sahampati here has more like, call it a kind of symbolic function, as representing perhaps the leader of, or the most powerful figure within the mundane world. somebody, you can say, who is representing the entire mundane world, the spokesman for the mundane world. And so somehow this Brahma deity is able to know what is going on in the mind of the Buddha. And then the thought comes to him that if the Buddha, the Tathagata, doesn't teach, if his mind inclines to inaction, the world will be lost, the world will perish, because there will be no way out of the bondage of samsara, no way out of ignorance and suffering to the state of nirvana, to deliverance. And so now Brahma has become alarmed, and he disappears from the Brahma world and reappears before the Buddha. And according to the commentary, when the Brahma comes, he doesn't, though in the sutta it seems like he's coming alone, but according to the commentary and according to other texts like the Mahavastu, when Brahma Sahampati comes, he comes with thousands and thousands of other divinities who are subordinate to him. So that it becomes a very grand scene with these maybe thousands, hundreds and thousands of deities amassing themselves in front of the Buddha, and they all bow down with Brahma Sahampati at their head. They straighten their robes in the proper way according to Indian custom. And then they plead, or Brahma Sahampati pleads with the Buddha. He says, "Let the Blessed One teach the Dhamma. Let the Sublime One teach the Dhamma. There are beings with little dust in their eyes who are wasting, who are falling away because they do not hear the Dhamma. There will be those who will understand the Dhamma." And then he speaks some very beautiful verses. He says, in Magadha, that's the state of Middle India, there have appeared till now impure teachings devised by those still stained. Open the doors to the deathless. Let them hear the Dhamma that the stainless one has found. Just as one who stands on a mountain peak can see below the people all around, so, O wise one, all-seeing sage, ascend the palace of the Dhamma. Let the sorrowless one survey this human breed, engulfed in sorrow, overcome by birth and old age. Arise, victorious hero, caravan leader, debtless one, and wander in the world. Let the Blessed One teach the Dhamma. There will be those who will understand. Then when the Buddha listens to the request of Brahma, now he says the important word expression, out of compassion for beings, I surveyed the world with the eye of a Buddha. That is, now he has this special faculty of vision through which he can look out upon the world, not seeing the physical world, but looking into the minds of all living beings, which are simultaneously opening up before him. And as he is looking into their minds, seeing their faculties, their dispositions, their inclinations, their previous karmas, their capacities for understanding, he sees that there are some beings with little dust in their eyes, others with a lot of dust in their eyes. In other words, some with just a little bit of ignorance left, others who are steeped in ignorance. Some with sharp faculties, others with dull faculties. Some with good qualities, others with bad qualities. Some easy to teach, some hard to teach. And some who see the danger or fear in morally blameworthy behavior and even in continuing to be reborn in other worlds. And then the Buddha, or the text, uses a simile. Just as in a pond of blue, red, or white lotuses, some lotuses that are born and grow in the water, thrive immersed in the water without rising out of it. These are the people, human beings, who are most heavily immersed in delusion and can't even see anything of the truth of the Dhamma. There are others which are born and grow in the water, but rise up and rest on the surface of the water. These are perhaps human beings who would be capable of comprehending more basic teachings, Dhamma teachings, but cannot attain any profound realization. And there are other lotuses that are born and grow in the water and rise out of the water and stand clear, unwetted by it. This would be those who will be capable, if they hear the Dhamma, of gaining liberation within that life. And so the Buddha says, I saw beings with little dust in their eyes and much dust, and so on. And then he makes the commitment to Brahma. He says, open for them are the doors to the deathless. Let those with ears now show their faith. In other words, now he is going to teach, and so let them arouse faith and listen to the teaching. Then he gives an explanation, thinking it would be troublesome, O Brahma, I did not want to speak the Dhamma which is subtle and sublime. Then Brahma Sahampati, after thinking that he's given the Blessed One, that the Blessed One has given him the assurance that he will teach the Dhamma, disappears right on the spot. And now the Buddha wonders, to whom should I teach the Dhamma first? And first, out of gratitude towards his teachers, he thinks that he will teach first to Alara Kalama, who guided him in the practice of the base of nothingness. But as soon as this thought comes into his mind, he realizes that what deities come to him and say that Alara Kalama died 7 days ago, and also he knows for himself through his special faculty of knowledge that Alara died just 7 days ago. Then he thinks of Udaka Ramaputta, his second teacher, but again he just realizes that Udaka Ramaputta died just the previous night. Both of them missed this opportunity to hear the Dhamma. Alara probably would have been reborn in the base of nothingness, and Udaka, if he attained the fourth state, formless state, would have been reborn in the base of neither perception or non-perception. Then the Buddha thinks, when trying to think to whom he should teach the Dhamma, he remembers the group of five ascetics who were serving him while he was striving. And so he decides that he will teach the Dhamma to them, and with the divine eye, he sees that they are now living in the deer park at Isipatana, which is near Benares. And so then he sets out to walk from Uruvela to Benares. That's a distance of several hundred miles, I think. And along the way, he passes an ascetic, a follower called an Ajivaka. The Ajivakas were one of the sects that were contemporaneous with Buddhism. They had a doctrine of an extreme type of fatalism, predestination, that all beings have to wander through the life, through the round of existence for a fixed period of time. They go from one existence to another as determined by destiny. Their own actions have no effect upon their destiny. Then when the fixed period of time is over, then they spontaneously become liberated. And so when this ascetic named Upaka passes him, he's very awed and impressed by the manner of the Buddha. He sees the Buddha walking down the road, very serene, peaceful, self-composed. And he comes up to him and says, Your faculties are clear. The color of your skin is pure and bright. Under whom have you renounced the world, friend? Who is your teacher? And whose Dhamma do you uphold? It would have been, at that time, it was expected that any teacher, religious teacher, or any ascetic belongs to some parampara, some lineage, and has received guidance from a teacher and is practicing under a teacher. And now the Buddha wants to indicate to him that he has attained enlightenment completely on his own and that he has no one to point to as a teacher. And so he says again in very powerful verses, I am one who has transcended all, a knower of all, unsullied among all things, renouncing all, freed by the complete ceasing of craving. Having known everything for myself, to whom should I point as a teacher? I have no teacher, and one like me exists nowhere in all the world, with all its gods, because I have no person for my counterpart. Maybe to Westerners, this sounds almost like boasting or really excessive claims someone is making. But in fact, the Buddha has to disclose the truth, and now he is the one fully enlightened one in the world, but there's nobody who is really his equal with regard to virtue, concentration, wisdom, liberation. Now he says, I am the accomplished one in the world. The word here is arahant. I am the supreme teacher. I alone am a fully enlightened one whose fires are quenched and extinguished. I am going now to the city of Kasi. Kasi was the state in which Benares is located. Actually, I think Kasi could also be another name for Benares itself. I go now to the city of Kasi to set in motion the wheel of Dhamma. In a world that has become blind, I go to beat the drum of the deathless. Then this Ajivaka says, according to your claims, friend, you ought to be, uses the expression, Anantajina, which means something like the conqueror of the infinite, here rendered the universal victor. And then the Buddha says, the victors are those like me who have won the destruction of the taints. I have vanquished all evil states. Therefore, I am a victor. And now, though this ascetic was presented with the opportunity to learn the Dhamma from the Buddha, he only says, I think the Pali should actually be translated, it may be so, friend. Not may it be so, friend, but it may be so, friend. Sort of like he's saying, maybe so, maybe not, but he's not yet ready to accept the Buddha as a fully enlightened teacher. And so, shaking his head, he goes down another road and he departs. But there's a happy ending to this, since according to the commentary, that this Ajivaka ascetic, after he took that bypath, after some time passed by, he met a nice girl and got married. Actually, he became infatuated with the daughter of a hunter. He gave up his ascetic vows and married her. They were living at home, but the household life was not all to his liking after some time. I think they had a child, and then his wife would taunt him and tease him, why you are living a life of renunciation, you gave it all up because of your lust, now you're just a slave to me, until he could take it no more, and then he left and went, and eventually he found his way back to the Buddha, and then became a follower of the Buddha again, became a Buddhist monk, and gained liberation. Okay, so now the Buddha, in time, he arrives in Benares, And by way of the time of the year, we've come to, this would be the full moon of July is arriving. And he approaches the monks in the group of five. And when the monks see him coming in the distance, they say to each other, "Here now the recluse Gotama is coming. He is one who is living in luxury. Look at him, quite plump and full. He's probably just spending his time eating morning, noon, and night, maybe sitting there listening to the radio, watching TV, not doing any real meditation practice. So we shouldn't pay homage to him as we did before. No need to rise up for him in respect or to take his bowl and robe. So we'll prepare a seat for him, and if he wants, he can sit down and join us. We don't have to expel him or keep him at a distance." And so they made this pact amongst them. But as the Buddha approached the five monks, they were still saying to each other, "We shouldn't get up to go out and meet him." But as they're saying this, they're all getting up and going out to meet him. They say, "We shouldn't take his robe and bowl." But as they approach, one says, "Please, sir, give me your bowl." Another says, "Give me your extra robe." And so they're unable to keep their pact, and then they come and they invite him for a seat, and they give him water for the feet, water for drinking. That's common courtesy. But they address him by name and with the word friend. They call him Avuso Gotama. The word Avuso doesn't actually mean friend, not literally. It has nothing to do with friendship. But it's a term of address that monastics or renunciates, I guess in ancient India, used amongst each other, expressing a relationship roughly of equality, that they're on the same level. And during the days when the Buddha was alive within the monastic order, the monks would address each other as Avuso. It's a word which means, actually it comes from literally one who has life. That's the sort of literal meaning, which doesn't really suggest very much. But it's a basic term expressing some degree of, you say, friendly respectfulness. But it's a term indicating rough degree of equality. But when the five monks speak to the Buddha this way, he says, "Bhikkhus, do not address the Tathagata." Here he uses this word, Tathagata, which comes from Tata, which means thus, and gata, gone. But sometimes it's explained tata, thus plus agata, come. So he is literally thus come one or thus gone one. To give some rough idea, we might translate it as the transcendent one, the one who is completely gone beyond. Or even maybe exalted one. Do not address the Tathagata by name and as friend. The Tathagata is an arahant, a sammasambuddha. He is an accomplished one, a fully enlightened one. Then he goes on to say, "Listen, monks, I have attained the deathless. I shall instruct you, I shall teach you the Dhamma, and if you practice as instructed, you yourselves here and now, through direct knowledge, will attain realization, and you will enter and dwell in the supreme goal of the holy life, for the sake of which you have gone forth into homelessness." But the five monks, with this statement, the Buddha is now revealing to the five monks his attainment of full enlightenment. And not only that, but he's showing that he is ready to exercise the function of a teacher, of a master to them, to teach them the way so that they too can realize the goal of liberation, the deathless. But though the Buddha has made such a such a great offer to them, they're not yet ready to accept it, because they still hold to the idea that the true way to deliverance is through the ascetic practices. And so they complain or protest to the Buddha, and they still even obstinately refer to him as Avuso Gotama. Friend Gotama, they say, by the practice, the performance of austerities that you undertook, you didn't attain any super states, superhuman states, any excellent knowledge and vision worthy of the noble ones. And now look at you. You're not fasting. You're not sleeping on thorns. You're not exposing your body to the sun and rain. You're eating quite ample meals. You're resting at night. You're clothed in robes. You're not going around in rags, naked. So how could you claim that you've become enlightened? But now the Buddha explains. He says, the Tathagata doesn't live luxuriously. He hasn't given up striving and reverted to luxury. But he is the accomplished one, the fully enlightened one. But a second time, the monks of the group of five protest in the same way. And the second time, the Buddha answers them and tells them that he doesn't live luxuriously. And then the third time, the five monks say to him, how could you have achieved any superhuman states, any distinction in knowledge and vision? And now the Buddha uses a different tactic. Instead of just trying to press his claim, he says to them, monks, have you ever known me to speak like this before? In other words, are you ready to trust me, to take my word on faith? Previously, you saw how I was practicing so diligently, so zealously, and yet I didn't claim to be who have attained enlightenment at that time. And now, when I'm claiming to be enlightened, do you think that I would be making such a claim if I had really given up the effort and was just living in luxury? And now they say to him, no, venerable sir. And the key word here, which indicates that they've changed their minds, is what? Venerable. Yeah, and in Pali, that's Bhante. Not me, it's Big Bhante. Yeah. In the time of the Buddha, the monks generally, they would use the word Bhante only for the Buddha, in reference to the Buddha, and they would address each other as Avuso. But when the Buddha was going to pass, just before he passed away, he instructed the monks, he said that, now after I pass away within the order, the junior monks should refer to the senior monks as either Bhante or Ayas Ma so-and-so, which means venerable such-and-such by name, whereas the senior monks can refer to the junior monks as Avuso. And so now it's traditional in Buddhist countries that junior monks refer to junior monks and lay people refer to senior monks as Bhante. Okay, so now the five monks have indicated by this expression, no, venerable sir, that they have accepted the position of students in relation to the Buddha. And now the Buddha repeats his claim and says that he's going to teach them the Dhamma and show them the path that will lead them to final deliverance. And now, according to the traditional narrative of the life of the Buddha, at this point, the Buddha taught the five monks what is called the Dhammacakkappavattana Sutta. This is called the discourse which sets in motion the wheel of the Dhamma. In other words, this is at this point, the Buddha gave his first sermon in which he explained, first, that the way that he discovered is the middle way, which avoids the two extremes of indulgence in sensual pleasures and the pursuit of self-mortification, of extreme ascetic practices. And then he disclosed to them the Four Noble Truths, the Noble Eightfold Path, and the different aspects in which he penetrated or comprehended the Four Noble Truths. But our present text just, it doesn't incorporate that sutta here. And so for this reason, some academic scholars say, for this reason, we can conclude that the four teaching of the Dhammacakkappavattana Sutta was not really the first sermon of the Buddha, that the Buddha didn't explain the Four Noble Truths, the Noble Eightfold Path, but he must have given just some rather informal instructions. But I think one has to understand that the compilers of the suttas couldn't try to fit everything within one sutta like this, so they kept the two texts separate. But if one looks at the beginning of the Dhammacakkappavattana Sutta, it's quite clear the Buddha is addressing the group of five monks, and he's explaining that he has discovered the middle path, which avoids the two extremes, which would be the quite appropriate approach for the Buddha to take when trying to make clear to the monks why he has given up the extreme ascetic practices, or how he could give up the extreme ascetic practices without falling into a life of luxury. Okay, so now over this coming period, the Buddha starts, actually he teaches the first sermon, and at the end of the first sermon, one of the monks named Kondanyo gains the first glimpse, the first realization of the Dhamma, and becomes a stream enterer. Then the Buddha, over the next week or 2 weeks, I think it's a week or 5 days or a week, he instructs the monks in groups. Sometimes two will go for alms round and bring back enough food for the six of them to eat. On other occasions, three will go on alms round and bring back enough food for the six to eat. And then the Buddha instructed, after explaining the Dhammacakkappavattana Sutta, within that first week, all the other four monks became stream enterers. And then the Buddha taught, when he knew that their faculties were ripe, he taught the Anattalakkhana Sutta, the discourse on the characteristic of non-self. And at the end of the discourse on non-self, then all the five monks together eradicated all of their defilements and attained arhatship. And so at the end of this period, here we're in paragraph 30, then the bhikkhus of the group of five, taught and instructed by me, being themselves subject to birth, having understood the danger in what is subject to birth, seeking the unborn supreme security from bondage, nibbana, attain the unborn supreme security from bondage, nibbana, and so on, being themselves subject to aging, sickness, death, sorrow, and defilement, they attain the ageless, sickness-free, deathless, sorrowless, undefiled nibbana, and the knowledge and vision arose in them. Our deliverance is unshakable. This is our last birth. There is no renewal of being, no more repetition of existence in the future. Okay, I stop here. And the rest of the sutta you can read on your own. I'm not going to explain it, because at this point we're covering the life of the Buddha up to his enlightenment and his first sermon or his first teaching. And from this point on, then we're going to go into the teaching itself, starting from next week onwards. I deliberately went a little longer. I didn't want to stop before we concluded this portion of the sutta. And I got permission from the authorities that we could have a little more time today. So if you have questions, then please feel welcome to ask. At that time, people lived in what they call extended families, which would be called, the word is kula. They write it. And so families were quite large, and generally the young men within the families were referred to as Kulaputta, which means literally sons of the clan. And the young women were referred to as Kula Duhita, which means daughters of the clan. Kula could be rendered like even family, but if we render Kulaputta as family man, it suggests somebody who has a family of his own, somebody with a wife and children. Whereas the Buddha sometimes refers to his fellow or to his monk pupils as Kulaputtas. And so, but they're not householders. Is that too clear enough?
I just wonder why
it just seems to have been a common expression. Yeah. Yeah.
Sorry.
Go right ahead, yeah. Debtless one and wander in the world? Wonder. No, it's wander, to walk in the world. I think it's vicharati. Vicharahi. Means to walk about. In other words, he's asking the Buddha to go walking from place to place teaching the Dhamma. Yeah. Yeah. It's the word is citta. The Pali word is citta. Yes, Jim.
Can you explain what the ball went upstream?
The ball went upstream. Don't forget that this is coming from, you might call the amplifications of the Buddha story, probably over by later generations, in order to include more miraculous elements to show that there's a way of underscoring that the Buddha is an extraordinary person. But it's basically within the context of that story of a way of giving the Buddha at this point, the Bodhisattva, the assurance that that day he will reach enlightenment. Say again? Actually, that's a good way to understand it. I don't think it was intended in that way. But within the verses that we've come across, we come across the word, this is on page 260, the expression is rendered, it goes against the worldly stream, pati sota gami. Gami is going, sota is stream, Sanskrit srota, and pati is here has a sense of against. So the Dhamma is what goes against the stream, the worldly stream, the stream of greed, hatred, delusion, are seen as a stream carrying people downwards. And so to follow the Dhamma is to go against the stream in the opposite direction. So that's a good way to understand the movement of the alms bowl. Yeah, yeah. Yeah. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Yeah. Yeah, yeah. In fact, the stream is often used in sort of Buddhist imagery to signify sometimes the stream of craving, or the stream of the world, bhavasota, the stream of continued existence. And then often the image of crossing the stream is used. In fact, when texts speak about saving beings. The word literally, it's tareti, which means to bring them across, across the stream. Or rescuing beings. The Buddha's mission is to rescue beings. It means literally his mission is to lead them across. Yes.
I understood what you explained about the different estimations. Is he says, oh, I'm not going to teach, and then...
Yeah.
I guess I'm sort of hung up on it, how he says that it would be wearying and troublesome.
Yeah.
That sort of seems incongruous with having attained nirvana, and that's the fact that anything could be wearying.
I think it's not in the sense that he'll feel subjectively annoyed, irritated, or worn out by this, but just I think what he's apprehensive of at this point is that he will go about teaching, trying to teach, trying to communicate, and just nobody will listen. And then he'll just be using his time in a futile way. And so in that way he'll be making all of this effort for no purpose. But subjectively, of course, as a enlightened one, he won't feel any irritation, annoyance. Any comments, or even if not questions, but any comments, reflections? Okay, next time then we will take the we leave behind the story of the Buddha's quest for enlightenment, and we come into the teaching itself through, I think, the heading that I use for this topic, approaching the Dhamma. And we approach the Dhamma through the well-known Kalama Sutta. This is not in the Majjhima Nikaya, so I've made it, but it's in the Anguttara Nikaya. So but I've made a printout from the Anguttara Nikaya, which anybody can take. But if any of you have the numerical discourses of the Buddha, then you don't need this. It's in there. It's page